Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the Two Mats for week ending Friday, the 25th of August, a podcast that looks to the stars. Matt, what did we talk about this week?
We talked about some quite serious and heavy things, from the death of Prigozhin in Russia, which has dominated the news in the last few days. And then We talked a little bit about Elon Musk and his power in America, and then we, in the second half, talked about the chilling case of Lucy Letby and tried to kind of unpack, you know, evil and what is there such a thing as evil? What is evil?
We did, and then we had a brief chat about the Indian mission to the moon and
we did.
And also
the World Athletics.
And the World Athletics tournament. Yeah,
yes,
so that was
absolutely
good. What are we going to call? What are we going to call the episode?
Should we call it "Touch of Evil"?
A Touch of Evil. Yeah, good. And we also touched on the fabulous new European subscription offer, which I won't go into full details. The full details will come up halfway through the podcast. But there's a
mystery.
Very, very good offer for new subscribers. So listen on. Okay, so this is the Two Mats, Episode 10, A Touch of Evil. So, Matt, what are we going to talk about this week?
Well, I think we have to talk about the death of Prigozhin. Famously led a brief mutiny against Vladimir Putin 2 months ago, and his plane on its way apparently to St. Petersburg from Moscow fell out of the sky. We don't know yet whether it was a bomb or a missile, but I don't think it was pilot error. and it was rather typically announcing this extraordinarily brief and dry way on Russian state television. Maybe our producer, the third Matt, could play a little bit of a clip from that news report.
Росавиация опубликовала имена и фамилии всех пассажиров бизнес-джета, потерпевшего крушение под Тверью. В списке в том числе Евгений Пригожин и Дмитрий Уткин. Всего на борту было 10 человек, из них трое члены экипажа.
So for those who don't speak, who aren't fluent in Russian, he was basically confirming 10 people were on that plane, including, we must remember, at least 3 people,
yes,
maybe more, who are totally innocent of any involvement in all of this awful business that have, you know, if Putin has committed this act, they were murdered alongside as collateral damage. But yeah, so, and you may have caught the names Prigozhin and Utkin, Dmitry Utkin, who also died in the crash too.
Dmitry Utkin is a very important figure in all this because he's the number two in the Wagner Group. In fact, he gave the Wagner Group its name because he's was a fanatical fan of Wagner's music. But also, I think it's fair to say, an even more fanatical fan of neo-Nazi ideology, and he used the salutation Heil amongst his troops. A very nasty piece of work, and probably operationally the key figure in the whole outfit. So this was classic Putin, very theatrical, unusually sort of quite close to Moscow, not elsewhere, not like Litvinenko being poisoned with the polonium in London, or the Skripal poisoning in Salisbury. This was a straightforward being shot out of the sky. We're obviously working on the assumption that it is Putin. It's interesting that on the Today programme, we're recording this on Thursday, on the BBC Today programme this morning, they had a guy called Sergei Markov, who is often brought on to discuss such matters. He used to be a spokesman for Putin, and he said, oh, this is obviously Ukrainian covert ops and designed to delight Zelensky. But I rather think we can dismiss that. Putin was caught off guard horribly by the coup in June. Certainly the weakest he's ever looked in his many years running Russia. And Prigozhin got quite close to Moscow. And I remember talking to someone in the defense world in Whitehall around that time who said, look, Prigozhin got as close to Moscow as Birmingham is to London. And if you get to Moscow and you take over, you've got 6,000 nuclear warheads, you know, under your control. So it was a pretty tight thing. As a consequence, Putin clearly made a decision, fairly weakened. There was a standoff, Prigozhin back down, but Putin didn't feel able to act immediately. But as is his wont, you know, famously, and it's been said so often over the years, he's a man with great patience and loves taking his revenge served cold. And actually this, you know, was only 2 months. So Prigozhin was allowed to gain a certain amount of license in the intervening time. He had a meeting with Putin in Moscow on June the 29th, which lasted for 3 hours. He was operating out of St. Petersburg. There was a video that came out only this week where he was in Africa, and there was some suggestion that Wagner was going to relocate to Belarus and get heavily involved in mercenary activities in Africa, which would be to the benefit of not only of Russian kind of colonial ambitions, but also, what, you know, the quest for mineral resources and fossil fuel resources. So that was where we were only a couple of days ago. And then I suppose it's one of those things that is more shocking than it's surprising.
Well, to that point, there are a couple of headlines which I thought were very telling. One in the Daily Star, the front page of the Daily Star, which read this morning, this is Thursday's paper, "No one at all shocked as warlord dies in air crash." And
then, they are very good.
Yeah.
They really do know how to write headlines.
Yeah. On the BBC, reporting how it's been covered, the story's been covered in Russia, the headline, "Most Russians far from shocked," you know, as Prigozhin meets his fate. I guess the big question for me is, well, two big questions. One is, does this make Putin weaker or stronger? And secondly, what could happen next as a consequence of what is being portrayed by Prigozhin's loyalists as what they quoted as an act of treachery by Russian traitors? That's what the media channel linked to the Wagner Group described this. And I wonder whether you think
Telegram,
Matt,
isn't it? Yeah.
Telegram, that's right. I think it's called Grey Zone, isn't it? On Telegram.
Grey Zone, anyway, yes, on Telegram.
What do you think this? You know, we've all said it's classic Putin. He deals, like you said, revenge is a dish best served cold, and he's in many ways it was shocking that Prigozhin lasted 60 days. But anyway, he's got his man. Does it make him look stronger now? Is this a signal? Mess with me and look what happens. Or does this now set him up for an act of revenge from the Wagner Group? Does it mean that the next time somebody says, I'm going to take Putin out, well, they make sure they go through with it and it does happen? Is he now in more jeopardy, or is he safer as a consequence of this?
It's a really good question because, I mean, obviously the first thing to say is that Putin is obviously not as weak as some, certainly in Ukraine, hoped, and some in the West hoped too, because he's now been able to, you know, on home soil orchestrate a straightforward assassination, it would appear. So he's no longer as weak as he appeared in the immediate aftermath of the coup attempt. So I wouldn't say he's back to his full strength, but you know, his many internal, not enemies but rivals, will be thinking, well, you know, we can't just assume that if we kick the door down he will crumple. But yes, I mean, Wagner is a very strange group, and it goes a bit back to what we were saying last week about, you know, Trump and the gangster state and the way that modern societies are changing in the way that they're organized and power is distributed. Prigozhin, as we know, was an ex-convict. He got out and he proved to be a very entrepreneurial gangster, set up restaurants, some of which were very high-end and patronized by Putin and others, lived the life of Riley, and then also got involved in the whole hacking and cyber warfare activity with a troll farm in St. Petersburg from 2013. So, you know, he made himself useful to Putin and then set up this body called, which became known as Wagner, which was by far the most powerful of the private mercenary groups that Putin decided to make use of, particularly in the early incursions in Ukraine 2014-15, when they wanted plausible deniability and also, frankly, savagery. Because one of the things that the Wagner Group is notorious for is savagery. You know, it was for that period of time, Putin enjoyed all that because Prigozhin was useful. And then I think that there came a point when Wagner took the city of Bakhmut in eastern Ukraine, and there was a sort of grandiloquence about him, and he was starting to complain about the defense apparatus in Moscow and how he wasn't being supplied with ammunition, and you could see there was a chilling, and Putin thinking, I'm this guy's getting too big, I've had enough. So then when we then had the sequence of events that led to the coup and to where we are now. As you say, Matt, there's a lot of Wagner people drifting around, milling around now, waiting to find out what their future is. Officially, all of the mercenary groups have been taken under the wing, under the auspices, by contract of the defense ministry. So Putin has effectively nationalized all these, you know, contract groups. But there are going to be a lot of very sort of angry and displaced people roaming around. The question is, do they really have any significant leadership? Do they have someone who can take the place of not just Prigozhin but Utkin, and, you know, represent some sort of significant threat to Putin? Well, not that we know of. But I think your broader point is the one to concentrate on, which is it's certainly the case that we are witnessing slowly and not in a linear way the fall of Putin. And by the way, it could take 10 years. I'm not saying this is going to happen tomorrow. But the key question, as always, in any security or defense issue, is how long does it take to get from A to B? So for the people who fancy themselves as the next leader of Russia, the question is, he's in trouble in Ukraine. He's now reasserted himself by taking out Prigozhin. When is the right time, if there is a right time, to strike? And you're right, Putin has put himself in a position where, you know, the logic now is to finish the job, because you know what's going to happen to you if you don't.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think there must be, I don't care how pathologically cool and calculating Putin is, there must be an awareness of his reality at some point in the future. He's got to go. You know, he's got to go at some point in the future. And, you know, his family will be in great jeopardy when he goes. He himself will be in great jeopardy. He can't leave Russia. He'll be arrested on the spot and thrown into The Hague. So there must be in his head an increasing sense of desperation about his personal reality right now. And perhaps maybe the brazen nature of this assassination, if that's what it is a reaction to that. The increasing stakes he finds himself in, which is, you know, he, as you say, he didn't do a, you know, an assassination by some kind of covert poison, or the guy didn't fall out of a window, or, you know, have a mysterious heart attack in a hotel room,
fall down the stairs shaving.
He blew him out of the sky on Russian soil with a surface-to-air missile. and then attended the BRIC conference yesterday, you know, cool as you like, and talked about, you know, strengthening the economies of the world.
Investment in Africa.
Yeah, investment in Africa. Very interesting point, by the way. You know, when we think about Putin, as we increasingly are led to believe, when we see a man totally isolated and, you know, friendless in the world, it's not true. It's not true. You know, Russia is still seen by a number of very important countries as a central power and an ally and, you know, an economic force that they want to trade with. And it's not that long ago that Brexiteers were talking about, the BRIC nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, as you know, likely trading partners to make up for the lack of imports and exports trade we'd be doing with the European Union. So he's not as isolated as we think, but he's clearly existing day to day in a state of high jeopardy. And that, I think, makes me incredibly nervous, because if he cracks one day, if that sense of jeopardy becomes too much and he cracks, God only knows what his reaction will be. And it won't be limited to taking a pot shot at a private jet.
It's always a good idea to take autocrats at their word. I mean, one of the things that I think in the age of the strongman autocrat, we in the West have tended, and even with respect to Donald Trump, to think, oh, he doesn't mean it. Well, he meant it. I mean, one thing we learned about Trump was he meant it. And I think Putin means it. And so whilst I'm not for a minute suggesting that Putin is going to use tactical nuclear weapons, when he says he might, he means it. It's not just a sort of empty, bombastic, vainglorious threat. He's telling Western publics as well as Western leaders, you do realize I am willing to use these warheads, which is, to your point, terrifying. The immediate future, I suppose, is also one that contains an important variable for him, which we've referred to in the past, which is the American presidential elections, because there's no question Putin is running the clock out, hoping that the next president of the United States will not be Joe Biden, ideally for him, Trump. But also, we've just had the first Republican debate in Milwaukee, from which Trump was absent. But most of the candidates were quite dovish about Ukraine and don't want to be seen as continuing what Americans call a forever war. So Mike Pence was very, very big on, you know, we've got to keep in there the values that are being protected there are, you know, crucial to the American way. But the general center of gravity in the Republican Party is, what are you doing? What were we even doing there in the first place? Yeah, they're nothing to do with us. Let's end this assistance. So you can see in Putin's mind, you know, November 2024, well, it's quite a way away, but it's not that long. If he can just hold on, you know, Zelensky's been touring Europe picking up F-16s. Clearly, the conflict is going to grind on almost indefinitely, I think, as things stand. There is no obvious off-ramp because the Ukrainians do not, at this point, want to negotiate. So for Putin, the off-ramp is provided by a fundamental change in the complexion and character of Western leadership, which is to say, who sits in the Oval Office. So I think those variables are real, and they contribute to what you said, Matt, about the volatility of the situation. You know, I do think with Putin, as with Trump, we should always work on the basis that anything can happen.
So let's put Prigozhin and Putin to one side for a moment and talk about another person who wields extraordinary, almost unique power within his nation, and even more than we thought, actually, according to an excellent article you sent me by Ronan Farrow in the New Yorker. Was it the New Yorker or the Atlantic?
It was in the Yorker.
And we're talking about Elon Musk. And I don't want to stretch. I don't want to stretch the comparison with Prigozhin too far and compare Musk directly to Prigozhin. But you are talking the portrayal of Musk's extraordinary power and hold over and influence over the White House was, I've never read anything quite like it in this article. And it was all based on Musk's control of the broadband satellite data that is being provided to Ukraine via his Starlink system. And yes, the extraordinary situation that the White House found them in.
As you say, it's a fantastic piece by Ronan Farrow, and clearly a huge amount of research and, you know, thought has gone into it. And for me, it's there's a big biography of Musk coming out later this year by, you know, the great biographer Walter Isaacson. So that's something to look forward to. But this piece, I think, is probably the best account of what Musk is, what he represents, how he fits into the modern culture I've certainly ever read, and I recommend it to all our listeners. And what he starts off with, Farrow, is the image of Musk offering to cover Ukraine with, you know, give it internet coverage through his Starlink's program, but then getting quite ratty because Musk said it was costing his company, SpaceX, $400 million a year, and wanting to, you know, get something back. And in the end, the Pentagon having to cut a deal. So, you know, Ukraine was dependent upon Musk. More to the point, the American military industrial complex was dependent upon Elon Musk. And what the piece then goes on to explore in chilling detail, actually, is how many American departments, and it's a long list, depend to a greater or lesser extent upon the cooperation of Elon Musk. So, you know, moving, as we all hope, moving to electric vehicles, you know, before long. But Tesla has so many of the charging points that you have to cut a deal with Elon Musk. All sorts of basic public services depend on Elon Musk being on side. And
NASA's entire space program.
And NASA's entire space program is, you know, dependent on SpaceX now. So it's an extraordinary moment. And I think the comparison with Prigozhin is really, is actually very interesting that you made, because, you know, Elon Musk does not have a private army that we're aware of. And he can't be president of the United States because he wasn't born in the United States, born in South Africa. But the way in which what we understand as the traditional bureaucratic state run by rules and laws and democratic processes and checks and balances is sort of crumbling before our eyes around the world. I mean, Elon Musk has many fans in the West, but I'm not sure they fully realize how much power he's aggregating.
The most extraordinary thing I thought in that article was when, in the middle of the negotiations over, you know, they didn't even have a contract with him about the provision of Wi-Fi. So it wasn't as though they could even just cut him in or out. You know, the White House, clearly, it had all been not thought through at all. And in the middle of these negotiations over, are we going to pay him some money or not, Musk drops the bombshell. Well, I spoke to Putin last week. And he told me that he thinks I'm interfering, you know, so it's costing my business, you know. And they said, wait, what? You spoke to Vladimir Putin one-to-one? Yeah, sure, you know. And so you've got the richest man in the world, potentially the most powerful individual, non-governmental, maybe including governmental, in the world, having a fireside chat with the most dangerous man in the world, and the White House didn't even know about it. It's utterly extraordinary.
The access and the ambition of the new cast of tech, you know, tycoons doesn't cover it, you know, they're giants. It never ceases to amaze me. I remember a few years ago, I met someone extremely senior at Microsoft, which is one of the least sort of zany and, you know, off the wall and Bond villainish of the companies. And kind of prides itself on its sort of sensible philanthropy. And I was talking to him and said, you know, well, where do you see all this leading? And without missing a beat, he said, oh, Microsoft and Google and Amazon, we will all have seats on the UN Security Council by 2035. And I you know, needless to say, spluttered somewhat. And I said, on what basis? Yeah. You know, because And he said, on the basis of power, he said. Now, I think he's wrong. I don't think the UN as currently constituted will, you know, you're not going to have bloody Mark Zuckerberg sitting alongside the representative of China on the UN Security Council. That is not going to happen. But the spirit of his ambition was extremely powerful, and I think something like that is a genuine risk, because, and we saw it in the pandemic. You know, you can't fight a pandemic without the assistance of all these companies. You can't do anything. And you have in America people now talking about, should we break up Meta? Is it too powerful? Similarly, people saying, has Elon Musk simply become too powerful? But there are very few, because most legislation was passed long before this technology gathered the power it has, and this technology we have in 2023 will look like nothing in 5 years. It's very difficult to keep pace. You know, we're all clearly on the cusp of an AI revolution, and then quantum computing will come in, and these guys control all of it.
Yeah, it's chilling. I remember about 10 years ago showing my bosses at the paper I was working at the time a video someone had made. It'll almost certainly still be on YouTube, and it was if people Google Zon, it was around the notional merger of Amazon and Google and the consequences of it, and much of it has played out. You know, extraordinary overreach of power that goes way beyond commercial interest. The way that, for instance, Google through Google News seeks to exert influence over editorial publishing without them being a publisher themselves. The way that they seek to make friends with big media by effectively giving them huge, huge grants so that people become dependent on Google as part of their business model. It's very frightening. And I can remember going to several editorial conferences where people from Google lectured journalists about how they should do journalism. And I found it appalling to look around the room as these lectures. One of them I remember particularly by a commercial guy, an advertising sales guy who ran Google Ads. And he was telling them what kind of news people wanted and what kind of news people should be given. And the most appalling thing about it was that nobody in the room stood up and told him to fuck off. You know, everyone was sitting there with their notebooks. These were like some of the most influential journalists, editors, chief executives in the world, in a conference room being lectured to by an ad sales guy about what editorial should be like and taking notes. It was pathetic. And, you know, you can see the consequence of that. That was about 10 years ago in Hyderabad in India. And you can see the consequence of it now, where people are fearful and dependent on Google. And, you know, I've got no time at all for the Daily Mail, as you know. But one of the things that I would credit them with is they've got a deep-rooted cynicism and a very hostile view of Google, because they recognize that Google has ambitions where it shouldn't. Now, Google do a lot of good in the world. Of course, the world's probably a much better place than it was pre-Google. But these big, massive corporations, and that's what they are, they don't have any real altruism. Their only sense of purpose is profit. These corporations need to be held in check by governments and by media, and it's not happening. And, you know, it's not happening because people are scared.
And also because people enjoy convenience. So Amazon is, for me, the model of this, which is that, as far as most people are concerned, Amazon is two things. First of all, it's the online shop where you can buy anything. And secondly, it's Prime. You know, it's a streaming service that if you buy enough on Amazon, you get for free. But actually, probably the biggest component of Amazon that has power is AWS, which gives it control over almost all of the internet. If AWS goes down or is withheld, we can't do anything. So with a cheery face and, you know, often with a rocket at his side, Jeff Bezos is holding a gun to the head of most societies, which is, you know, okay, if you don't like this, fine, but then you're not going to have AWS. So as with Google, it looks like a search engine, but we all know it's something completely different. It's an algorithmic data collection force that uses data as people used to use gold. You know, it's the most valuable commodity in the world. And I think that you're right, Matt. The governments of the world are 20 years behind the curve. And I hope that some of the new governments coming in, you know, appreciate that.
Last quick anecdote before we go for a break is I was the first journalist in Europe to interview Jeff Bezos when Amazon was just a bookseller, right? And that's all they sold. And I asked him, I said, you know, so, okay, so you've got this new book platform. What's next? And he looked at, and he has this mad glint in his eye and this even madder laugh. And he put his head back and laughed and he said, well, then it's going to be gardening and garden furniture and music and CDs. And he went, oh, and then wedding dresses. And I said, where does this stop, Jeff? And he said, it's called Amazon. It never stops. It's the biggest thing in the world. And it was, and the insanity, but also the crazy brilliance of the man.
The reality was
absolutely, it was breathtaking to behold. Anyway, let's take a quick break and we'll come back and talk about something that is absolutely fascinating in possibly the most horrific way you can conceive. So, see you after the break. So, thanks for listening, folks. As ever, I'm going to try to encourage you to subscribe to The New European, where you will get on a weekly basis, or a daily basis, in fact, online, this kind of conversation from luminaries, including the wonderful Matt D'Ancona, but also Alistair Campbell and Will Self, Patience Wheatcroft, Bonnie Greer, a host of fabulous writers with very interesting things to say each week, and also a plethora of great cultural and artistic features from across Europe. And it's a type of journalism you won't find anywhere else. And I'd like to say it's the antidote to the corrosive nationalism of much of the UK's right-wing media. So, this week, I have a very special offer for you, and it is from our fellow podcaster, Mr. Rory Stewart from The Rest Is Politics, and he's got a book out called Politics on the Edge. It's a fascinating look at the last 9 years of his involvement in politics, and I think I've seen the proof from the publishers. It really is. You'll love it, Matt D'Ancona. It's an intriguing look into the ins and outs of politics and what may be going wrong and what could be done to improve it. And new subscribers can get a free signed copy, signed by him, not me, you'll be glad to hear, signed copy of Politics on the Edge when you join The New European from as little as £1 a week. So just go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2Matts. That's the number 2, then M-A-T-T-S. What are you waiting for? Do something positive about UK media and get a free copy of Rory Stewart's new book by subscribing to The New European today.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome back to all of our listeners. Hope you're enjoying the show. Welcome and back. Thank you, by the way, for listening, because we're climbing those charts, and we're please tell your friends all about,
really grateful.
About the Two Mats thank podcast. You. This week has been one of the most extraordinary stories of my journalistic career, and it's been you know, wall to wall coverage. So there are few angles left to explore about nurse Lucy Letby, the killer of seven babies and an attempted murder of several more, eight more, who was sentenced to spend the rest of her life in prison on Monday. And I can't remember a trial that has suddenly captured people's well, to say it's captured their imagination. Well,
maybe Jamie Bulger.
Yeah, that's probably the
is probably the right. The only comparator in my lifetime anyway. Yeah. I can think of.
Yeah, obviously it's been wall to wall coverage. And again, God Almighty, mustn't make a habit of this. But another shout out to the bloody Daily Mail, who did a fantastic podcast. Which has been the number one podcast in the charts following the trial of Lucy Letby. But one of the things that I can't get out of my head, and I'd love to explore it with you a bit because you're more intelligent than me and you'll be able to explain it, is what's the difference between evil and insanity? And when does somebody who is so blatantly evil as this woman is, in her own words on that post-it note, "I am evil," When is somebody so evil and abnormal that you've got to treat them as being insane? You know, and if they're insane, do you have to treat them in a way other than just locking them up for life? Does a compassionate society? And I know people will be throwing the radios or the laptops out of the window at this point with me suggesting this about somebody who is so beyond the pale. But is there some other response to that level of evil?
It's very hard, isn't it? Because, and needless to say, there's been a lot of thought over the decades to this. You know, is there such a thing as evil? And philosophers call it the problem of evil, because one of the difficulties of evil is, as an idea, is that because it's, we hope, a word used not too often, it's reserved for extreme cases like this. Does it then zone those cases off as somehow different and keep us out as analysts and explainers, and, you know, the attempt to determine what allowed this to happen, whether it could be being prevented, and so on? I think evil is worth keeping as an idea. And I think part of that is because of the history of the 20th century. The thing I've read about evil that had the most effect on me was Primo Levi's book, If This Is a Man, which is his account of, as the first book he wrote about being in Auschwitz. And when he arrives, Primo Levi, he asks one of the guards why, looking around. And the guard says, "Hier ist kein warum," here there is no why. And I think that's a really, you know, Primo Levi in all his writings resisted over-analysis of what the Nazis had done on the basis that there were certain acts that were evil and they shouldn't be kind of dismantled into sociological factors, psychological. I mean, he was perfectly aware about the circumstances that had brought the Nazis to power. But what he didn't want was for those factors to be sort of put in a package and say that's why the Holocaust happened. Levy's point was that's not enough. Now, obviously, that's a hugely different and unique historical event, and it, you know, it would be quite wrong to to say it's the same as what happened in the hospital where Lucy Letby worked. But the case of Lucy Letby is very, very instructive because she does seem to have been a totally unique individual. There's this thing, Munchausen's by proxy, which a lot of speculation has gone into, she's got it, which is, just to listeners don't know, it's a condition where typically caretakers are so damaged themselves by certain elements of their upbringing or their genetic profile that they harm the people in their care as a means of gaining attention. And it may be, although no one, it's really important to underline, no one has diagnosed her as having that. In fact, what's interesting about the investigating officer and in officers and indeed the judge was that none of them, I think very sensibly, have attempted to offer a pat explanation for why she did what she did. And so when we're looking at it, there doesn't appear to be any great trauma in her background. Maybe we'll learn more. You know, her parents were very supportive, although one could say they were perhaps over-supportive. I mean, supportive to the point where, you know, they were turning up in court and, you know, they had earlier threatened to take the doctors who sounded the alarm to the General Medical Council. Now, at what point does the protective instinct of a parent become almost a form of quasi-complicity? I don't know. But what I do know is that if we go too far down the line of saying, well, it was all the management's fault, and it certainly was, and she shouldn't have been allowed to enter a grievance against those who were making allegations against her, and she certainly shouldn't. And even the notion that she was able to get away with it for as long as she did because she was, a cheery-looking white girl, that it was white privilege at work. Maybe so, but that's clearly not the main reason. You are confronted, as one is, I think, quite rarely, with a person who deserves to be called evil. It's not just that the acts they commit are evil, that the scale, intensity, and moral extremity of what they do deserves that word, and we should reserve that word for we shouldn't use it very often. But I think this is an occasion where it deserves to be brought out.
I completely agree with that. And I in trying to identify exactly what to call Lucy Letby, I was searching around and reread that great Hannah Arendt treatise on Adolf Eichmann, where she identified what she called the banality of evil. And it struck me that, although, of course, again, just as in the Primo Levi example, the cases are wildly different. But it did strike me that there was a slight connection in that what is so shocking about this is how banal she is as an individual, you know, how totally vanilla. In fact, I think that's one of the titles on the Daily Mail podcast episodes, The Vanilla Killer, and what Hannah Arendt called Eichmann terrifyingly normal. And that, I think, is the most chilling, you know, when you think about Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, you know, mad, schizophrenic, insane
Jeffrey
person.
Dahmer,
you know,
obviously
Jeffrey Dahmer,
crazy.
You know, there was something a bit mad about Fred and Rose West as well. You know, there was something identifiably
absolutely
evil, you know. But Lucy Letby, plain, you know, boring, middle of the road, mediocre, a kind of nobody, but this extraordinary inner life, you know.
I'm so fascinated that you mentioned Arendt, because that phrase, the banality of evil, has caused so much trouble over the years, because I think people misunderstand what she was trying to say. I don't think she was trying to say banal and therefore okay. On the contrary, what she was trying to say is what you just said, is that this could lurk anywhere. Don't kid yourself it couldn't be next door, and don't kid yourself either, and this is where we really get to the bone, that it could be within you. Now, you know, we hope that's not true, but I think that's the key, is that you notice whenever there's a terrorist incident and someone is held who's been suicide bomb or whatever, there's then a startled profile. It's, you can set your watch by it the morning after, saying, but he was such a normal guy. You know, he played cricket, he enjoyed school, he had mates. As if the capacity to do something like that is by definition, inconsistent with leading a normal everyday life. Now, terrorism we can sort of park over here. It's a separate issue. But what it does have in common is we're so trained by myths and stories and fiction and movies to think that the evil person is thoroughly evil. You know, Dr. Evil, Darth Vader, you know, they are grotesquely evil and there's nothing about them that isn't evil. The chilling thing about this case is that it reminds us that someone who in every other aspect of their lives, in their social media life, in their friends, in their family life, might be completely and utterly unremarkable, nonetheless commits a crime of, I mean, almost unendurable horror. It's very, I think people have struggled this week, just talking to people, to get their heads around this, because it involves systematic, devious, prolonged harming and killing of the most vulnerable beings there are, often premature children, and doing it over a period of time. This was what she did. You know, this was what she clearly existed to do this, and she was incredibly cunning, you know, and knew exactly how to prolong her time doing it. I mean, remarkable, horrific.
And the enormous consequences that this will lead to, I don't think are close to being played out. I mean, there was in the backwash of the Harold Shipman case, there's now something called the Shipman effect, which is where doctors, end-of-life care doctors, are very nervous about over-prescribing morphine to relieve pain for terminally ill people, because they're scared witless that somebody will say, you're hastening their death. And this is a direct consequence of Shipman. And so there are people every day who are in greater pain towards the end of their lives than they need to be because of that bastard. Now, this bastard, Lucy Letby's consequence, will be, I'm sure, a decrease in trust and a nervousness and increase in anxiety in neonatal wards everywhere, and a sense of depression amongst those amazing nurses who are at the sharp end of looking after those precious babies. My firstborn was in a terrible state when he was born, and we spent 2 weeks in intensive care at UCLH in London as he made a full recovery. But I can remember feeling utterly lost and amazed at the dedication of those nursing staff in that hospital who nursed him back to full health, and feel gratitude to this day, 18 years later. And the thought that those people who are massively under the cosh, you know, I read today 43,000 nurses in England vacancies. We're short of 43,000 nurses in England alone.
They're overstretched.
Mate, 366 nurses in 2022 tried to kill themselves, according to the Laura Hyde Foundation, who deals with that. Now, so you are dealing with a population of very caring people who are already under intolerable pressure through all sorts of governmental cuts and, you know, shortages and all sorts of stupid decisions made about the NHS. And then they have this. And they must feel, and I would just encourage anybody who knows a nurse or encounters a nurse to just bear that in mind and be as grateful and as positive with them as you possibly can be, because they are angels.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that it's really important that whatever follows, it's clear that Steve Barclay, the health secretary, as he does, got it wrong by limiting the inquiry that must follow to just an independent inquiry. And you could see Gillian Keegan this week, the education secretary, saying that a full public inquiry is very much on the table, and I am as sure as I can be it will be a full public inquiry, because that has the powers to get people to testify and produce evidence as there must be in this case. And I hope that what comes out of it, to your point, Matt, is not some sort of greater suspicion of nurses, but a greater suspicion of what's happened to the NHS in the way that it's been taken over in the last 40 years by management. And that management is not subject to the same sort of professional regulation as the as nurses and doctors and so on are. It really isn't. And some of the things that have emerged in this case about the ability of NHS managers to shut down really legitimate inquiries and to talk horrifically about the potential for reputational damage to the trust. I mean, that seems to me a kind of a rudimentary, you know, key first principle issue about how the NHS is structured. The extent to which hospitals act like businesses now, you know?
Yes. What didn't we talk about?
Well, in other respects, India made history by landing on the moon and becoming the first nation to land a probe in the South Pole region. And it's incredible. Here we are. India joins that elite club of nations that have achieved a soft landing on the moon. There's only a few of them. There's the States, the former Soviet Union. Modern Russia hasn't done anything in that regard. And China. I am a space junkie. I find all this sort of stuff incredibly exciting, and I'm thrilled that India has joined in. I know it can be misused in nationalist propaganda, but it's fantastic.
I've turned 180 degrees on this in the last 24 hours because I've railed against the Indian space program on the basis that, you know, as I'm sure many of our listeners who've been to India, you see such abject poverty in India that people just are generation after generation are consumed by and condemned by. And I thought, what the bloody hell are they doing sending missions to the moon? You know, if they're going to spend money, then fix the sewers in Calcutta, you know, that kind of reaction. But I have to say, when I saw two things, one, that it was a lot cheaper than I'd thought. It was done on a shoestring, this mission. Mm-hmm. I think it cost 60 million or something like this in terms of like very light payload, very low development costs. So it was a lot cheaper than I'd suspected. But also I did think, you know, one of the key constituents, and you can apply this more broadly to other nations and not look too far from home, one of the key constituents to a healthy society is a nation that's proud of itself. And I did think
exactly
that maybe those people in Calcutta and in Mumbai and Chennai and all the people who live in horrible conditions, as Oscar Wilde said, you know, they might be living in the gutter, but now they are literally looking up to the stars. And maybe that's a national positive.
And talking of looking up to the stars, we talked last week about the Lionesses and commiserate with them, but are proud of them for how they perform. But one thing that happened as a consequence of the match and the tournament was that no one at all is taking any notice of the World Athletics Championship, really. And Josh Kerr just won a gold in the 1500. Amazing performance, you know, stunning. And I think on the same night as the Lionesses' performance in the final, Katherine Johnson-Thompson, another underdog, won the heptathlon, you know, which normally if it hadn't been for that, the World Cup had been on, we'd be on the front cover of the on the front page of newspapers. So it's looking good for the Olympics in Paris next year. It's very exciting.
Good stuff. And lastly for me, just while I was waiting to come onto this to record the podcast, I got an email from Roger Waters' organisation saying that his new version of the song Time from Dark Side of the Moon has been released. So I listened to that. Do you want the verdict?
I do. What's it like?
Bloody awful.
He's Roger,
honestly,
that.
It's so bad it's worth listening to. It's
really?
Like he's lost the plot completely.
I will check it
Poor
out.
Poor old Rog. Anyway, you can let me know what you think next week.
I will. I certainly will.
Well, thank you very much for listening. And folks, remember our special deal with signing up to the New European and get a free signed hardback copy of the brilliant Rory Stewart's new brilliant book, Politics on the Edge. That's at theneweuropean.co.uk/2MATS. That's the number 2 MATTS. And there's a link in the show notes. Thanks as ever to the Third Mat producer, Matt Hill at Rethink Audio. And until next week,
it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Goodbye.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.